Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords.
This is the Rental Income Podcast.
And now, Dan Lane.
My guest on the podcast today wants to remain anonymous. He doesn't want to use his real name, say where he is, or reveal how many properties he owns. And that's fine. I can totally respect that. I will say that I did talk to him before the show, and he does own a good number of rentals, and he's been very successful. So I think we can learn a few things today without getting too personal. Welcome to the show. I guess my first question for you is, in your opinion, do you think that any property can be a good investment as long as the numbers work?
No, I would not say that. And that's one of the greatest misconceptions in real estate that I would really like to just stamp out. You know, most people have rented a car. Mm-hmm. So we've seen the cars that you find in the rental car business, and they're not Porsches and BMWs, right? They're a certain kind of car. It's not just that they're the cheapest cars. It's that they're a certain type. And what that certain type is that those cars that provide the most basic functions only. Because people that rent a car, mostly they want to get from here to there, and they want to get there safely. They don't want it to be, you know, 8 gallons per mile. They don't want it to be expensive. They'd like it to be safe. Mm-hmm. Those are all the basic functions of a car. Anything else is a luxury. And that's really what you want in a rental property. I only do single family homes. There are people that do apartments. I don't do apartments. That doesn't mean I think they're bad. I just don't do them right now because they don't meet my plan. But single family houses have certain advantages, and there's a rise right now in the rental of single families only. I was just reading an article the other day that there's a whole class of older renters now that simply refuse to live in an apartment. Mm-hmm. And they're actually creating now build to rent single family homes.
Wow.
So, it's almost hard to wrap your head around that concept, but we're going to be seeing that. We traditionally think of single families as being owner occupied, but, there are lots of renters in this nation, and they want to live in houses too.
Sure.
And the thing about houses have certain advantages, one of which is that the tenants tend to stay for very long periods of time. And one of the things I like about them is that they can be converted to a retail sale, in theory, if it hasn't become a rental only neighborhood. So the thing about a house that you want is just like that rental car company wants for their cars. You want the things about a house that make it most valuable are the basic functions. It protects you from the wind and the snow and the cold. It shelters you. It has a roof, a floor, and four walls. It's got plumbing, electrical, you know, hot and cold running water, a kitchen to make food. Those are all important functions, and that's what people pay the most for. Anything else is a luxury. And a luxury, by definition, is that thing which is not necessary. So pools, barbecues, fancy flooring, all the upgrades that you have in expensive houses, those aren't necessary for people, and they don't make for good rentals because you don't get a return on that part of the investment because they're not necessary. Pay for is function.
So you're not putting in granite. You're not doing stainless steel. You just want the pure basics.
Well, granite is one of those things that in theory, there could be cases because it's so indestructible, although apparently it stains. You know, there are certain things that that have higher durability. Granite is so expensive that I don't know if it would meet that requirement. But definitely, I'm not necessarily saying that you have the lowest quality materials, say, in your kitchens or bathrooms. I like things that are durable. It's like I like brick houses for that reason, because it lasts a lot longer than vinyl. But you don't want to pay for anything extra. So you really want three bedrooms, two bathrooms, about 1,200 to 1,500 square feet, and none of those other things that I mentioned. And luxuries have another problem that come with them. Not only are they not good as on the return side of for being a rental, they break.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want things that your tenant can break that aren't even necessary. and or that could cause you a liability. I have a property manager who recommends removing all disposals, because no matter how many times you tell people they're going to have to pay for the service call, their kids are going to stick, you know, pencils down the disposal and clog it. And although I'm pretty used to having a disposal, I'm a middle-class guy, they're not necessary. People live without them, and they cause a lot of problems.
Right. It's just one more thing that's going to go wrong and going to cause you heartache. What about garages?
Garages, you know, I haven't even figured out garages. There's really an odd thing with them. To me, in where I live in California, garages are an absolute necessity. I never see a house without them. Mm-hmm. But in the East Coast, the last place you would think that garages are not a necessity, they're not. There are new housing. I have new houses that I bought in North Carolina. The whole development doesn't have garages. So it doesn't make any sense to me, and I can't figure it out. But apparently, they're not a necessity.
What type of neighborhoods do you like to buy in?
Good ones.
Okay. So you're looking for like the A-class top neighborhoods, or do you want more of like a working class neighborhood?
I'm looking for the highest return on my investment. Okay. That's what I care about.
Okay.
Without, you know, being in a neighborhood that's a meth lab. My test, so I'll take the worst neighborhood that a property manager is willing to put up with. That's really the test. If the property manager won't manage properties there, if they won't even go down the street, you don't want it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's talk about ROI. You mentioned that you want the highest ROI. What kind of ROI are you looking for when you're evaluating an investment?
Well, I have a number in my head, and it's just a rule of thumb. It is, you know, just somewhat arbitrary, but not completely. And that's 10% as a minimum. That's what I'm looking for. Now, why 10%? Well, first of all, we have something to compare it to, the stock market. Mm-hmm. What is the historical return long-term of the stock market? Well, they used to always say it was 10%. After recent events, they now say 8.5%. So I'm a conservative guy. Let's say 8.5. Mm-hmm. Well, due to the tax advantages, the extreme tax advantages of the stock market, which are better than real estate, frankly,
Let me question on that, because like real estate has really good tax breaks with the depreciation.
It does. But so, I knew you were going to call me on that. Yeah, that's a whole other discussion.
Getting too much into it, you really think the stock market is better tax-wise than real estate?
Yes, but with an asterisk I'll get to. Yes, okay. Because you can't beat a long-term capital gains rate and dividend rate of 15%.
Yeah.
And not only that, you can move. You have the Supreme Court of the United States has said that you can earn all your capital gains in a state that taxes you, like California. California doesn't, like many states, doesn't have a capital gains rate. They just tax everything as ordinary income. So I would get whacked pretty hard if I, you know, cashed out in California. But I don't have to do that. I can wait till I'm ready to retire, move to Tennessee or Nevada or Alaska or Florida, and cash everything out, not pay any state income tax, and there's nothing California can do about it. The Supreme Court has decided that.
Okay.
So I think that's a huge advantage. Yes, I'm aware there's all sorts of clever trickery you can do in real estate. But my point is, stocks are a push button investment. Mm-hmm. You can sit, you know, on your bed and trade, you know, buy a low cost ETF or mutual fund and get that return and beat all those taxes without really doing anything or taking any risk beyond the investment itself. And that's the part of stocks that's hard to beat. Everything else about it is inferior to real estate, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So with real estate, with doing a little bit of work, you actually have to get out and really select properties and so forth. You can get a higher return. And I recommend that people do that. But you do have to be selective.
Sure. So 10% is the benchmark that you're looking at. Now that's 10% after all your expenses, right?
Yes.
Okay. So,
but it's also including everything, which includes the long term depreciation, other things that you don't get right off the bat. You're probably. I do have some properties where I actually net 10% just from the rentals after all expenses. But those are things that you may not be able to just easily find.
Yeah, let's talk about these deals, because you were telling me about some of the properties that you were buying at crazy low prices a few years back.
Yeah.
Tell me about these deals, or tell our listeners about these deals.
Well, yeah, I found quite a few deals in North Carolina. These are newer construction houses. I mean, these were houses that were built in 2002, 2003. They were meant to sell for like $110,000 back then. Mm-hmm. And I picked up quite a few of them for in the low 50s.
How are you finding them?
Well, they found me. Okay. I guess what happened is that I had let it be known that I was looking for a certain type of property. Mm-hmm. And no matter how much you tell people that you're only looking for a single family home with good cash flow, they still come after you with everything else.
Sure.
Flips and other things. So you have to kiss a lot of frogs. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened is I found a number of people that had tried to compete with the hedge funds and bought foreclosures and flipped them and run out of money. And so they were willing to let the deals go for less than they had hoped.
Okay.
So I bought two, and then I bought another one, and then another one, and then another one, and another one. So once you start buying them, they come after you.
Right. Now, were you buying turnkey rentals, or were these properties that you had to coordinate some kind of rehab on?
Well, I'll probably get in trouble saying this, but you know, there's turnkey and then there's turnkey. It seems that everybody and their brother and their mother and grandmother are getting into the turnkey business.
Sure.
And they may have been in business a whole week. So you want to really check it out.
Right.
These guys, you know, in theory, I guess they were, you know, they're working class guys that were fixing up properties, and they fancied that they'd be in the turnkey business. And one of the things that these people will do is they will find you a tenant that is, let's say, not quite what you're looking for.
Right.
I always joke that they go down to Skid Row. Hey, you want to play the part of a tenant? Here's $100. Yeah, just get a shave. So one thing that I do. Since in turnkey rentals, the providing the tenant, a suitable tenant, is part of the deal. I want to see the tenant's application. I want to see the full application, and I want it. You need to verify that they've actually collected a deposit.
Right.
Because in some of these cases, they don't even collect a deposit. Oops.
Wow.
So it was supposed to be turnkey, but it ended up, you know, the tenants didn't work out and I had to find new ones. But my rate of return, I was getting 1.8%, you know, I'll tell you the actual numbers. One of them I bought for $53,000 and the rent was $850 a month.
Wow.
So yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
But understand that that's a lower quality tenant, because you're not going to get people with good credit scores, and they're going to be evicted. Some tenants at the low end, they literally get evicted almost every month. Mm. And they have to, it's really sad to watch. And if I could figure out a way, you know, to help them out, I would do it. I even told my PM I wanted to lower the rent. And I said, I would take a lower rent if you can get me a better quality tenant. He goes, we tried that and the courts won't back us up. They'll say, you know, that's just, they would not consider the discounted rent as the real rent.
Mm, so, okay. Wow. So is it hard like to find someone you can trust down there to manage the properties without it being something that you can?
It's always hard to find somebody to manage properties. Always, that's a tremendous challenge. You know, you read all the guru real estate books out there. They say, "Don't manage your own properties. Don't manage it. They're going to neglect your property. They're going to charge you, and they're going to mark up everything." All true, mm-hmm. But you know what? That's terrible advice.
Right.
Do not manage your own properties.
You know,
like ever. That's terrible advice. And
you know, I think that kind of goes down to a fundamental thing of what your role is going to be. Are you an investor, or are you someone that this is going to be your job to manage
your
properties?
You are correct, sir. I would totally agree with that. And this is how people get in trouble. They don't clearly see what their role is. I want to be strictly an investor. I don't want to have a job. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm in a position where I can do that, but I don't want any muddling of, you know, me going down there and replacing carpet and taking out trash bins of stuff and then trying to figure out how much that's, you know, I should bill myself for doing that. I want to make executive decisions. When you're best off, I think, doing real estate investment as a CEO, you want to be an executive. You know, the executive doesn't go down and clean the washroom. The executive makes decisions that affect the other workers. You want to learn to work through other people. You want to learn to manage your managers. Just because you have property managers doesn't mean that you just let them do their thing. Right now, my friend and I are going over with a fine-tooth comb three different management contracts, because management contracts, they write the contracts, and that's always bad. Mm-hmm. We'd like to write our own contracts, but that's kind of hard to sell. So we're going through and finding all these very onerous things that we can't live with in management contracts and saying we can't use that manager because we're not okay with giving them power of attorney, for example.
Right.
So you always have to manage your managers. So, just like you would have to in a company, you have to manage your employees.
On a daily basis, how are you managing your manager, or are you even getting that involved on a daily basis or even a monthly basis with your properties?
That's a good question. And I'm actually trying to figure out how to automate that. I now have a friend who's not really a partner, but I brought him in just so that we could share information on the same things. You know, that's going to be a question, is how do we direct the flow of information to us? Like, I have to constantly tell managers, I need you to tell me if somebody doesn't pay their rent, if they're late. Mm-hmm. I need to be told if you had to do a service call. You know, there's one that's very good about that and the others are not. I need you to, I'm not going to give you permission to re-sign a tenant without me looking it over first. I need to get them to always tell me about relevant things happening with my property at the time they happen.
Mm-hmm.
And since they're not going to do that, I have to have a system where I don't just notice 3 months down the line that, hey, I didn't hear about this property. So my daily work, it's not really daily. It's, you know, several times a week, consists of reading emails from my property managers and going over, at the time of month when I get all my direct deposits, and you should always get all direct deposits, checks. This is 2016.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Believe me, you want to anyway.
Right. Makes life so much easier to get those direct deposits.
You know, like you will find so much of the real estate world really isn't in the 21st century. You still have people that are signing contracts by paper. Right. I refuse to do that. I want to do only electronic signature. So I have records of everything. And like, I get all the notifications from my HOA that my tenant hasn't trimmed the palm tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why can't I redirect that to the property manager? Well, because it's just not set up to do that.
Right.
They want to notify the owner for legal reasons. But I would say that's the premier challenge of owning multiple managed properties is to control the flow of information and make sure you have to proactively seek it out and notice when you're not getting it.
Well, that about wraps things up. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with a brand new episode next Tuesday. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.